This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Hey Chicago, I'm Claire Lane in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around until the end of the episode to get a rundown of the latest news you need to know about. But first, the official state bird of Illinois, any guesses? It's the Northern Cardinal. Back in 1929, it beat out the bluebird, the meadowlark, the oriole, and the bobwhite. The city of Chicago has an official bird, too. Here are a few hints. It's a bird of prey. It can dive at more than 200 miles per hour, and some of its most notable nests are on the UIC campus. It's the peregrine falcon. Cardinals, falcons, yes, we respect them. But in this next conversation, we're going to tell you everything you need to know about a visiting shorebird that's stolen many a heart here in Chicago, the piping plover. Here at the table with me, Liza Lair, Assistant Director of the Urban Wildlife Institute at the Lincoln Park Zoo, Bob Dolgan, Director of the documentary Monty and Rose, Daniel Suarez, Conservation Director for Audubon Great Lakes. Liza started us off by talking about the status of the piping plover population in the Chicago area.
The piping plover has been nesting here since 2019, which is the first time in 70 years that we've seen them here in Cook County. So really exciting. The Great Lakes population is considered federally endangered, and it's still considered that. Even though we are starting to see that population begin to grow, we're up to, I think, around 90 nests last year, which is really exciting. In the Great Lakes population. Here in Chicago, we're continuing to have some piping plovers show up each year, this year as well. And we're excited to see Imani back and Sea Rocket. And so, you know, we're continuing to see that population grow at a kind of a slow rate, but it's still considered to be an endangered and at-risk population. I think the goal of the population is around 150 nests. Of the Great Lakes population, we're seeing about 90 as of last year.
And Daniel, talking about sort of the previous numbers, I guess what caused the depletion of this species of shorebird?
Yeah, historically, development has been responsible for a lot of that loss of habitat right up on the beach. In most recent years, it's really disturbance and conflict where people and these birds all want to be on the beach in the summer at the same time.
They seem to sort of seek out the conflict in some ways when they're selecting their nests, which makes them, I think, especially interesting. So you're talking about, you know, being in urban areas. What other factors have contributed, you know, to the depletion, but then to this rebound? I mean, they're nesting in similar areas, but why are we seeing, you know, their species start to be saved a little bit?
Yeah, they're a very opportunistic species. So they will exploit habitat as it's available. And they tend to arrive in the Chicago area in April before we're really on the beach en masse. And so they kind of stake out their areas. And then
Bold.
As the people, yeah, and then as people start coming in, those conflicts start arising. But, you know, off-leash dogs are a huge problem for this species. Predators, you know, skunks, raccoons, other birds, murrelins, grackles have all been observed predating these nests. And interestingly, you know, climate change, as with everything, plays a factor. factor. So as the Lake Michigan storms increase in severity, you know, that can wash out nests. But then also just the water levels in the lakes themselves can influence how much beach habitat is available. So years of high water shrinks the available habitat for those piping plovers and brings those conflicts a little bit closer together. In years where water levels are down, like we have had the last few summers, there's a lot more habitat available for them.
Yeah, I mean, even in the last 8 or 9 years, I mean, we've all seen Lake Michigan, sort of those beaches be wide and vast and wonderful, and then really just almost look like a trail certain summers. Liza, tell us a little bit about the birds. What is a piping plover? They are small, but they are mighty. Just tell folks a little bit about what they look like. What are they?
So they are adorable.
They're cute.
Yeah, they're these, you know, quite small, but as you said, very tough and mighty shorebirds. You know, they really love to be on this dune habitat. You know, they arrive in the spring each year. They're going down, they're migrating down to kind of the Atlantic coast during the wintertime. But we see them back in this area sometime around April. They'll stay through July, maybe early August, and then start to move on. Yeah, they're really cute and they're really charismatic. They kind of look like these little puffballs on legs. And I think they've just won the hearts of a lot of Chicagoans.
And they are quite small. I mean, the size of a, what would you say, a tennis ball in some cases with legs?
Yeah, that's pretty close. And they can be really hard to see. So I think that's one of the challenges of them nesting in these areas where we have a lot of people, is that they can be hard for folks to see and sort of, you know, just be aware of their presence on the beach. You know, that can be a challenge for sure. They're much smaller than, say, there's another shorebird that hangs out in the area also called a killdeer, which has some very similar markings. But if you actually see them side by side, a killdeer is, you know, I would say almost two-thirds, maybe to twice as big as those.
Longer legs.
Yeah, longer legs, just kind of bigger bodied. You know, slightly darker too in their markings. Those plovers can just be hard to see, but it's worth it to go out there and kind of make the effort, bring those binoculars.
Hence the binoculars.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, Bob, you certainly have more than a few pair. You made a whole movie about these tiny birds. For you, what was the draw? What makes them so special?
Well, I think just growing up around the Great Lakes, like even seeing a piping plover once a year, you'd be excited. And then to have them show up in Chicago and decide to nest was even more shocking, I think, going back to 2019. And then there were just so many things that happened in that first year. They lost their first nest due to high lake levels. They, you know, had to fight off a music festival that was planned for the beach that drew headlines. Mambi on the beach. And you just had the big problem of how do you protect these birds on the most public beach in Chicago and maybe the most popular one. So there were just a lot of different factors. And then you saw how protective they were of their chicks, of their territory, how they fended off larger birds, potential predators. There were just so many aspects to it that one might not have ever experienced unless you were there like every day observing them. And so I personally learned a lot through the process. And then with the film, the goal was to be able to share that with a broader audience.
And there is, you know, and there has been here in Chicago, a narrative to follow. Let's listen to a clip from your 2019 documentary, Monty and a Rose.
People were really rooting for these plovers to succeed. They wanted to make it. So we started seeing a lot of volunteers email and sign up.
And at that point, we really didn't know what the response would be or how many volunteers we would need. We just knew that we wanted to try to cover as much of the daylight hours as possible.
People were always stopping by. Most of them were really excited that this was happening here. So I think it speaks well for the efforts of the Park District to create natural areas and to maintain them in a way that makes people understand nature a little better.
Tell us, Bob, what are we hearing in that clip?
Right. So those are some of the volunteers who came out in that first year and many who are still volunteering now 7 years later. And so we were talking about the community that had formed around the plovers, which I think was really special, and how there were you know, passersby, people we didn't know at the start of the experience, we got to know, people who had a boat docked at the harbor who would walk by every morning on their regular walk and say hi and say, how are the plovers doing? And like that, just to see that emerge suddenly from, you know, starting like with two anonymous plovers at the start of that year to something meaningful. They picked up the names Monty and Rose, named after Montrose, of course. And just to have that be an endangered species in our this major urban area, it was trying to convey that there were a lot of people, not just the serious birders, who were interested in the story.
The beachgoers.
The beachgoers. And like even the volleyball players, when Monty and Rose set up their second nest on the volleyball courts, and the volleyball season had to be sort of interfered with. people took it positively. Like people were generally very receptive to the bird's presence. So it was just a very positive story. And people who didn't know much about birds, we would show them the plovers through the scope. They are very hard to see. They're very, very small. To be able to tell a story about birds, like wild birds of that size even, was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're teaching a child something, often it's through a narrative, through a story. Monty and Rose, for many people, you know, a gateway to learning more about conservation and birding. But Chicago really became kind of obsessed with this story. I guess anyone wants to take this. Why do you think this Monty and Rose, this story, this saga is so appealing for Chicagoans?
I think a big part of it is the fact that these birds are all individually banded. And so we can track these birds year after year. Most of the time they return back to the same place year after year. They connect, the birds are not just connected between the sites across the Great Lakes, but it also connects the human communities that are caring for them too. So I think it's just a really good example of how you put a name on something and you start caring about it. And the fact that these birds can be tracked year after year, you know, you build those stories and you start seeing that connection.
And you're talking about the tracking with banding. Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah. So yeah, each bird is captured and they put different color band combinations on their legs. And so even though they're very tiny, through a scope, you can recognize those color combinations and key in on which individual that bird specifically is.
And that's how we know kind of where they end up, where their wintering grounds are, for example. Because we have the monitor community, the piping plover people here, that track them, but then they're all over the country. So you've got fellow birders that are familiar with this tracking process, with the banding, and then they, you know, they don't send a pigeon with that information, but they correspond. You know, there's a network of people that tracks and really cares about these birds.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of what happens here in Chicago as well. So we've had individuals that have shown up that have been banded, but they weren't necessarily here from Chicago. And so the community here has been able to report back what those bands were and find out where they came from and sort of information share across all of these different areas where people are monitoring plovers. And, you know, they've really, you know, captured the hearts and attention of so many people all over. And so it's really exciting to be able to see people that want to learn more about them and kind of find out where these populations are going.
Has that been interesting to navigate for you guys, just, you know, as now being a resource for people? Certainly the media, what's the latest, what's the status? But you've got community members that are sort of wanting more information. They're wanting merch. They're wanting photos. I mean, it's like they're the Beatles of shorebirds.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the volunteer effort, which has been mighty, as well as our wildlife officials from the state and the city and the federal government, like it's just been a lot about education. And so you have varying levels of awareness that people have when they come up to the beach. But for the most part, people have been respectful, and I think thankfully most folks know now not to go into the fenced off area where the plovers are. And so if anything, that's been a positive, because you just don't see that very often with a really positive nature story like that just taking off.
And this story, nature story, a love story, a legacy story now. Liza, how did the story of Monty and Rose unfold?
Yeah, so they came to the beach back a few years ago, and it was just a really exciting time to see them breed and have chicks and be successful. And then unfortunately, Monty came back and Rose did not survive, it seems. We don't know what ended up happening to her, unfortunately. But since then, we've had their chicks go on and be successful.
Tell us more.
Yeah, and also have chicks. And so Amani is here again. Amani has had chicks in previous years and is here again with the same mate from last year, Sea Rocket. So we're really hopeful that, again, this year we will have continued success.
And Amani was fledged in 2021, and he is now, he's been back to Montrose every consecutive summer, which is part of the appeal of this. I mean, the waiting with bated breath for the return, and then Sea Rocket arrived. A Sea Rocket, we should note, she sort of came to the elements in some way. So there are, you know, still things that can happen to these birds, right? Which is why there are plans and strategies and conservation efforts, including wildlife education in the Chicago area and beyond. So what are some of those efforts to try to keep these birds around for years to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a lot of monitoring. The birds that are there in that given year, we need to do everything we can to ensure that their survival. So there are monitors around the clock. You know, Bob already mentioned some of the groups, but Chicago Bird Alliance, Chicago Ornithological Society, Illinois Ornithological Society, the DNR, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Chicago Park District, and a team of dedicated volunteers, some of which knew nothing about birds when they started and others that were hardcore birders. And they basically are keeping tabs on them around the clock. So once there's a nest observed, you know, it's making sure that those eggs are being incubated. If one of the adults are predated, unfortunately, you know, that's where action might come in, and they might retrieve the eggs and rear them in captivity and then release them later in the season. So
and that happens pretty frequently now. I mean, it wasn't Sea Rocket was from a nest and then was placed in Waukegan or close by?
Yeah, I think last year there were close to 40 chicks that were captively reared and released. And because Michigan has traditionally been the stronghold of the population, they try to bring those birds to those other states like Illinois or Wisconsin to try to see if they'll take, because the research shows that those captive rear chicks usually do return to the place where they were released. And so that gives us an opportunity to try to somewhat artificially expand that population.
And they're still considered an endangered species, we should say, in the Great Lakes.
They are. They will be considered for delisting if they reach 150 breeding pairs that are maintained for 5 years. And we need to see 50 of those breeding pairs outside of the state of Michigan.
And just quickly, is there anything we can do as beachgoers, as community members, to sort of keep the species protected?
Yeah.
Leash your dogs.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things that we've been working on at the zoo, as well as with all of these amazing partners, is helping to encourage folks to not bring their dogs to the beach. So, you know, please don't bring your dog to the beach. It's technically not allowed to have dogs on the beach in Chicago, except at the dog-friendly area. The Montrose Dog Beach is one of those areas that's just up the beach from where the piping plovers are. We encourage folks to check out our Piping Plover Pal Pledge. If you're a dog owner, you can sign that and learn all about how to be a responsible dog owner, and really to share the beach with everybody. So the Montrose Beach is for everyone, for the people, for the wildlife, for all of the recreating that we love to do there. And there's ways that we can kind of share that space, give the plovers their space while we can enjoy it as well.
That's Liza Lehrer of the Urban Wildlife Institute at the Lincoln Park Zoo, Daniel Suarez, Conservation Director of Audubon Great Lakes, and Bob Dolgan. You can watch his documentary, Monty and Rose, on YouTube and PBS.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Let's turn now to the news of the day with WBEZ reporter Summer Van Benten, WBEZ Midday anchor Lisa Wabas, and WBEZ and Chicago Sun-Times investigative reporting fellow Nicole Janine Johnson. You've probably been hearing about an outbreak on a cruise ship of the hantavirus. It turns out there's a potential hantavirus case in Illinois unrelated to the cruise. Lisa gave us the update.
First of all, you're okay. You're safe. You're good.
We're not at risk.
Right. So the Illinois Department of Public Health is investigating a potential case. We don't even know. It could take about 10 days to find out whether this person in Winnebago County actually has contracted hantavirus. Winnebago County is the area roughly around Rockford, in case you're not quite sure. Officials say this person was likely exposed to rodent droppings while cleaning a home. They've recovered from mild symptoms. They didn't need to be in the hospital, and they weren't on the cruise ship that you've been hearing a lot about on the news. And also, this is a different strain than the cruise ship strain. So it's not the Andes strain of hantavirus responsible for that outbreak. So, you know, we're going to find out more. And anybody on that cruise ship, not from Illinois.
But safe to say it's best maybe to avoid rodent droppings.
I think that's probably, you know, a pro tip. A good idea. Yes.
So, Nicole, sort of a catchy headline on the Sun-Times website from our colleague Cam Rodriguez, but a pretty serious topic since we're on the serious bandwagon this morning. Die 80, this is the headline, Life and Death Near Southwest Suburbs Booming Warehouse Hub. So what's the story about? What are some of the main takeaways? What do we need to know about I-80?
Yeah, so this investigation pretty much tells the story of the warehouse boom that's in pretty much been in rural southwest counties of Cook County. And the intersection of that warehouse boom where you've got the big corporations like Amazon and the increase in truck traffic and the fatalities that have been increasing over the last few years as a result of them not only being on the highway, but also the local roads to get to the warehouses. And if there's traffic, them trying to navigate that because they're so crunched for time.
And certainly, you know, with some of the trucks, some of these semis using local roads, they're doing some damage to the infrastructure, also, you know, to the environment. What do, you know, residents and local government need to know? How are folks trying to address some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, so you've got people that are organizing because you have, there is a statistic that says that there's been at least over the last four years that there's been one fatality every month. So you've got people that are pushing their elected officials to put a temporary, they're temporary, but like stop signs, speed humps, slow traffic, increasing the surveillance with the police officers to ticket those drivers so that they're not going on these side streets. But those are just fixes, and they're not necessarily really addressing the root cause of the situation, which is the fatalities.
I mean, I used to drive I-80 through sort of the south suburbs, and people are going, I mean, sometimes over 90 miles per hour. Some of these semis are going well above the speed limits. We all love to complain about traffic, infrastructure, I mean, methods for creating safer roads, reducing crashes aren't always popular. You mentioned speed humps, Nicole, more crosswalks. Anything you guys would like to weigh in?
I just want to go fast. You know, drive fast and take chances. No,
I think the other thing here is just this one day shipping that everyone wants their deliveries fast. You want your Amazon pack
expedited,
and so it's
overnight
and that's that. And Chicago being this transportation crossroad of the country, you've got so many trains and ships coming through here to get packages, goods all throughout the country.
Something we'll be keeping an eye on. Turning to schools, Lisa, Chicago Public Schools announcing some actually pretty big changes to this $732 million deficit. What is the district proposing?
Okay, we don't have actual numbers, but the district says, you know, layoffs of regular teachers look likely. And so based on a new, you know, funding formula, Sun-Times and WBEZ did some analysis, and we figure that between 700 and 800 classroom teachers could be laid off under this new formula. The district says it wants to increase spending on special ed teachers, also classroom assistants, physical and occupational therapists, speech pathologists, officials. Again, they're not really giving numbers on this, but, you know, they've lost COVID funding. And I think we have a clip from Macaline King, who's in charge of the district.
Yeah, let's roll
the
it.
The progress of our students is evidence that the additional staff did a tremendous job. However, the relief funding is now gone, and it's difficult for the district to support that same level of staffing.
So essentially, they hired a bunch of teachers. They had the COVID relief money to do it, and now they don't necessarily have the money to keep these teachers. So
right.
Layoffs.
Exactly. And they're also planning to raise that student to teacher ratio. If you think, you know, there's not enough teachers for your kid now, the plan is to increase that by one, you know, by one. So if there's one teacher for every 23 students in your classroom, that's going to be 24 students. So, you know, it doesn't sound very good.
Well, it's also a big measure for what people, parents talk about. Oh, at my school, you know, there's a 4-to-whatever one teacher ratio.
Right.
I mean, any thoughts on this, Summer, Nicole?
Yeah, it's very disheartening because it's so easy for us to have these conversations in a back room. But these are our children we're talking about. Mm-hmm. These are the next generation of leaders, of decision makers, of civic engagers. And we can take away a teacher easy, sure, but that's yet another student who is now at harm, who won't get the resources that they need. And I'm actually doing a story right now reporting on special education teachers and the resources that they either have or that they may be lacking. And the consequences of these decisions, they're real, and they impact not only the students, but families.
Mm-hmm. And we knew Macaline King would have, you know, a big job taking this role, and that's seeming like that's happening already, making some big decisions. So, Nicole, turning to you and something you've been covering since 2020, over 2,000 Cook County residents have lost their homes and equity when their delinquent property taxes were sold. So remind us about what this story is.
Absolutely. So this is when you're delinquent on your property taxes, the county can sell them. If you don't redeem them within 2.5 years, they can actually pursue the deed and purchase your home and your deed. There is the amount of taxes that you owed, and then there's the amount of what the home was sold. There's surplus equity that people are owed, and the court found that the people that lost their property, Cook County was liable for the damages. Cook County knew exactly what was going on, and that they did not do anything to stop it.
Money left on the table,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
And it went to the tax buyers instead of the homeowners to at least make them somewhat whole.
And the county is now going to have to pay these residents back?
Yeah, so in the next couple of months, they will have to find out exactly what that process will be, how people can seek damages. There is a bottleneck actually in Springfield because this is... Illinois is the last state to be in compliance of the Supreme Court ruling in 2023. So there is also some movement that needs to happen on the state side to change how we do property tax foreclosure sales.
And something you're going to watch
absolutely.
Continually.
Yes.
If they even have the money to do this.
Right. The state could chip in, but the county is on the bottom line there.
Summer, let's flip to some other money.
Mm-hmm.
Who is footing the bill? Chicago taxpayers could be on the hook to fund a massive development that would create what the city is calling a cultural and entertainment district around the United Center on the west side. So what's going on?
Right. If you've been to the United Center or to, you know, Malcolm X College area, you've seen the development and you've seen the construction. There are pros and cons, and I think there's nuance to the conversation. For a little bit more context, The City Council's Committee on Economic Capital and Technology Development voted unanimously to provide around $60 million in tax breaks for the first phase of this massive development. And they're planning to have an entertainment district with 6,000 seat music halls and public parks, hotels, residential housing. And it sounds really flowery. It sounds really sexy. But there, you also have to consider the residents who once lived in these areas as well. You have to think about, okay, we're getting new housing. Can those who lived in these areas afford this new housing, or is it just going to further push them out, push them away? So it's definitely an interesting conversation, and it's interesting to hear how these different stakeholders and parties are weighing in as well.
And there are certainly advocates for this project, including our mayor, mm-hmm. Brandon Johnson, saying this will bring jobs and that development to the West Side. But you were at a Repair Chicago's town hall meeting at Malcolm X College mm-hmm. in April, residents bringing up concerns, as you mentioned, about housing. But what else did you hear?
Yeah, so I heard a number of concerns. For context, and we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, but, you know, Chicago is continuing this conversation around reparations and what that would look like in 2026. We have this, you know, 40 acres and a mule concept, but that may not apply in 2026. And so some residents brought to the table that, you know, we have all of this construction in the city, but is that further displacing residents, or is it going to be affordable for those who once lived in these spaces? They also talked about these vacant lots that we see on the south and west sides in particular, and how they're not being transformed into affordable housing. Another concern is that, you know, these plans to create housing are options that are, you know, I guess I just said that, but are affordable for folks. So as, you know, the city is working on these plans, how much are they considering the residents? But also, like, it could be fun to go to an entertainment center around the United Center.
Well, we had similar discussions, you know, when the Obama Presidential Center was in the planning phases. Residents in the Jackson Park community had the same questions. Right. So in the circle goes round and round. Nicole, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it really begs the question, if you're talking about jobs, what kind of jobs are those? And what is this quote unquote trickle-down effect that it will be? You mentioned the Obama Center. That's down the street from my home. We've just got one hotel, but otherwise, you've got a lot of speculation on houses, on housing prices, as well as rent. So who wins? And I'd be curious to see, what would it look like if the people got a $54 million tax break?
You know, that's right? The other thing. There's so many people who are struggling right now.
Well, and don't forget, the United Center is still going to be the United Center. So it's still going to be offering what it offers, bowls and hawks and all kinds of concerts.
Exactly.
So in the sports news arena, the name for Chicago Fire Stadium, it's new. It's
McDonald's Park.
Is it the Big Mac Park?
Something like that. The Big Mac Park.
The Filet-O-Fish.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Sure.
The McRib is back.
The McRib Arena.
Right.
They did strike a deal this morning
they
on this
did.
Name.
They did. So it's going to, I think, start, the naming rights start in 2028, I believe, or seven, I'm not sure. But yep, McDonald's, this is the first time they've had naming rights for an arena, and that they're going to keep those for several years. So we'll see, you know, I'm assuming they'll be selling concessions.
Chicago Fire Happy Meals for all. Shifting gears from sports to music a little bit, Lollapalooza just dropped the daily schedule. Did any of you check it out?
Oh,
any acts
you know
catch your
eye?
I know, you covered it. You are one of our Lollapalooza correspondents.
An official title. I'll make leadership known. I am definitely tracking, but also tracking the conversations around it as well. Those that I'm keeping an eye on, of course, Olivia Dean, Leon Thomas, Justine Skye, Freddie Gibbs. But I'm really intrigued because as soon as the schedule dropped, I saw a lot of people saying they didn't love the scheduling, let alone the lineup. So I'm curious to see what the crowd will look like this year. I feel like it's evolved year after year, especially as the lineup has shifted and the target has shifted. So we should see. We shall see.
But when I pulled up the lineup, the font was so small that I couldn't even see
it's not for you.
Reader,
it's not
Claire.
Not
shouts
target
out
audience.
To you, Lisa.
You're not the target audience.
Yeah, for real.
I mean, the target audience.
Mary Dixon and I were joking this morning. I was joking with Mary. I'm like, who do you know on this list? And we could name a handful of bands, but you know, Friday night is for the olds with the Smashing Pumpkins.
Billy Corgan will be there.
Charlie XCX. So, yeah. You know, we went when it was a traveling thing in mm-hmm. the 90s.
Speaking of culture, I'm looking forward to Sheila E. at the Millennium Park in June.
Like, I would rather go to that.
That's
going to
be high.
Yeah.
That's going to be
high. I'm also covering the Forever Mine Festival. That's coming up at the end of the month, which should be another. I think there are a lot of options this summer for mm-hmm. different crowds, mm-hmm. Which, you know, we love a Chicago summer.
Price points.
And yeah. Sueños coming Sueños up.
Yeah, Memorial Day weekend.
Yep.
It is summertime shy almost, but Summer, you started some reporting on the sounds of the Chicago River Project just last weekend. This is coming out at the end of the summer, but tell us a little bit just quickly about the project and what you got to see people do by the river.
Yeah, so just as a reminder, this is a contest encouraging Chicagoans to use sounds of the river to create music. Round one wrapped up at the end of April, and now round two is open. I went with Planet Chombo and some sound producers on Saturday to collect sounds of the river, and it sounds like crazy, but like connecting nodes and magnets to plants and to the river and all of these things, and hearing the sounds of the river, also the sounds of birds and the sounds of trees, and how they will soon be, you know, mixed together to create these really awesome pieces.
So people were really taking that seriously. They're trying, they're thinking of beats, they're thinking of rhythms.
Yeah, we even joked while there, we were like, we got to get Kanye on the track. Like, we have to get Northwest on the production
maybe Channel
team.
Maybe we'll start with
Channel. Channel
Chance.
Be a good
maybe. Maybe
Chance will love to get in on that.
Yeah,
Chance will get love.
Nicole, anything else that you're following this week news wise?
Looking at the state legislator, their movement on property tax legislation to change how we do the property tax auction. So Springfield, they let out at the end of this month, and something hopefully should be percolating soon. So I'm checking with our correspondents in Springfield to ask questions on the floor to see if we can get any momentum. Otherwise, have to look to October for that. But that's definitely number one on my docket right now.
Summer?
Covering again, working on some reporting on special education professors on the South and West sides, doing the Sounds of Chicago River story. And following some daily items as well.
As you always are.
Yeah.
We have been speaking with WBEZ Summer Van Benton, Lisa Lavis, and Nicole Janine Johnson.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.